Hello, I'm Rithula Shah. Thank you for downloading the World Tonight podcast on Monday, the 17th of June. On the programme, after days of protests in Hong Kong, we hear a Chinese view of events in the city. Also, we have a special report from China's far western region of Xinjiang, where more than a million Muslims are thought to be held in secure facilities. Mohamed Morsi, the former Egyptian president, died after a court appearance today. We'll hear from an opponent and a concerned Conservative MP. And as Iran says it'll breach the limit on its stockpile of enriched uranium by the end of the month, we ask if that will mark the end of the nuclear deal. After days of protests by hundreds of thousands of people, one English-language newspaper in mainland China has acknowledged that Hong Kong has been in turmoil. However, the China Daily insists that the demonstrations against a bill which would allow extradition to mainland China were small-scale and were specifically against the US interfering in Hong Kong affairs. Beijing's extremely sensitive about any kind of protest, and there has been tight online censorship of terms and pictures related to the events in Hong Kong. And if Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's leader, was hoping that her decision to postpone the bill indefinitely might help to calm things down, she probably wasn't counting on the democracy activist Joshua Wong pitching in. Moments after being freed from prison, he added his voice to calls for Carrie Lam to step down. As a student, Mr. Wong became the face of the Umbrella Movement protests 5 years ago. He also repeated popular demands to scrap the controversial extradition bill.
Millions of Hong Kong people joined the demonstration and protest within the past few weeks. What we ask for is Carrie Lam, the evil chief executive, should withdraw the extradition amendment. Hong Kong people will not keep silence under the suppression of President Xi and the chief executive Carrie Lam. Carrie Lam must step down. Otherwise, I believe in the next few weeks, before the 22th anniversary of Hong Kong transfer of sovereignty, more and more Hong Kong people, not only 1 million or 2 million people, will come and join our fight until we get back our basic human rights and freedom.
Joshua Wong. Well, today's protests outside the Legislative Council building, or LegCo, were much smaller than at the weekend. But campaigners insist they'll keep the pressure on. They fear the extradition bill could bring Hong Kong more decisively under China's control. So what is Beijing's view of this highly visible and determined opposition? Victor Gao was an interpreter for Deng Xiaoping. Now he's chairman of the China Energy Security Institute.
The protests in Hong Kong are massive in scale. And the people in Hong Kong living in a democracy have the rights protected by the law to demonstrate and protest. However, they need to do that within what the rule of law would allow. Therefore, disrupting social stability, hurting police, injuring police, and preventing access to the LegCo, for example, these are not allowed by the law. I think because of this, the mainland Chinese government has called the demonstrations, or at least part of that, as riots and should not be tolerated in Hong Kong, especially injuring policemen in Hong Kong.
But how do you think Beijing will react? We've already seen Carrie Lam having to apologise. It seems that the demonstrators will accept nothing less than the withdrawal of this bill. Will Beijing be prepared to accept that?
No, I think Carrie Lam has decided to suspend the legislative review of this bill for the moment. And we do not know what exactly will be the next step. I don't know whether Carrie Lam has apologized for anything. I personally believe she would not apologize. She actually demanded that policemen should be respected and law enforcement should be respected. No one in Hong Kong has any legal right to injure a policeman, for example. And as of now, the key is to bring stability back to Hong Kong and promote rule of law rather than and chaos.
And will that mean that Carrie Lam has to go?
No, I don't think so. She has a term, and I think what the Hong Kong government has done is perfectly legitimate. They basically want to go through the legislative process to decide the amendment of a bill. Extradition is the rule of thumb among many countries and jurisdictions and regions in the world. Hong Kong itself has extradition arrangement with about 20 countries. China as a whole has an extradition arrangement with about 40 countries. And in the age of today, where many crimes are committed across boundaries, for example, judiciary cooperation between and among jurisdictions are absolutely crucial to make it sure that we have the protection of the people and we have the rule of law prevailing among different jurisdictions.
As China has become richer, Hong Kong's value as a place to do business has arguably declined, but it still has a role and it still has an identity that is separate from mainland China. Is that what's being fought over right now?
No, Hong Kong is unique and Hong Kong is an extraordinary place to live and to do business. I happen also to be a permanent resident in Hong Kong. I have the right to vote and to be voted for. Therefore, I think in the coming 30 years or so, Hong Kong will maintain its very extraordinary characteristic, and it will always be a little bit different from anywhere in mainland China. However, allow me to add another point. Hong Kong, over the past 30 years, has not really devoted itself to development as the top priority, and it tends to lag behind some other cities in mainland China, especially its neighboring city, Shenzhen. Shenzhen, by now, is larger than Hong Kong, more people in Hong Kong, and the GDP size is in excess of Hong Kong's. Therefore, if Hong Kong cannot get its act together and cannot really do its homework and devote itself to development, Hong Kong probably will lag behind many other mainland Chinese cities, and by then it will have less advantage compared with the remaining part of China and will find it more difficult to really strike out for its unique position in international competition in the world.
Victor Gao there. Well, more from him in a moment, because nowhere is China's fear of unrest and upheaval more clear than its far western region of Xinjiang. The BBC's been given rare access to the vast system of secure facilities thought to be holding more than a million Muslims. After first denying their existence, the Chinese authorities now insist that the facilities are just schools built to combat the rise of violent Islamic extremism through job training and language lessons for the region's minority groups, many of whom don't speak Chinese as a first language. Last year, our China correspondent John Sudworth exposed the rapid development of secure internment facilities in Xinjiang. Now, despite the access being tightly controlled and the itinerary set by the government, his latest report uncovers important evidence about the nature of this system and the conditions for the people inside it.
Seated at school desks, in rows and wearing uniforms, this could be any school. Except these aren't children, they are adults. China used to deny that hundreds of thousands of Muslims were being placed into giant secure facilities like this one. Now, though, it's giving us a tour. And this is what we've been brought here to see. A room full of Muslims dancing, broad smiles set on their faces, a scene offered up as proof that they are not prisoners, but students, willingly being guided away from extremism.
Nice to meet you. What name is it, Zhao? John?
How
long have you been here?
We're free to ask them questions, but of course, our accompanying government officials listen closely.
Is it your choice to be here?
Yes, I was affected by extremism. Our town police told me to come here and transform my thoughts.
Have you been convicted of a crime?
I didn't commit any crime. I just made a mistake.
Thought transformation, China says, is its unique response to the outbreaks of separatist violence that Xinjiang has long suffered. And it's targeted specifically at Muslims, Xinjiang's Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other minorities who speak their own languages and have their own distinct culture. Upon being labelled extremist, they spend their days rote learning Chinese and studying the increasingly restrictive laws on religious practice. And they spend their nights sleeping in dormitories.
There are six bunk beds, steel bunk beds, very, very sparse in terms of people's belongings. Most seem to have just two plastic boxes under their bed. And then over here, If we look behind this curtain, a very thin blue curtain, a Chinese squat toilet, and the shower as well. But for the people sleeping at this end of the room, it's basically right next to the toilet. Very, very little privacy at all.
In the art room, I ask the principal, Mahamuti, what would happen if someone said they didn't want to come here.
I have never had such a case, but if we did, we would proactively guide them.
That doesn't sound much like a choice to me.
This is a training centre. They come voluntarily.
It isn't a place where people have to come, obey the rules, stay until you allow them to leave. Sound more like a prison, even if it's a prison in which you can do some art.
I don't know what you mean by prison. This is a training centre.
Satellite photos show that the places we're being taken to have recently been modified. Internal security fencing and what look like watchtowers have been taken down. And sports facilities have recently been added, on display when we visit, and raising the suspicion that these are show camps, a sanitised version of a much larger system into which Muslims are being swept on a very broad definition of extremism. Rakima Senbei spent over a year in the Chinese camp system just for having WhatsApp on her phone. She was released in December and now lives in Kazakhstan.
They put cuffs on my legs when I arrived, and I wore them for a week. And you can be beaten. Once I was beaten with an electric baton.
Rakima was moved through a series of different camps. Only towards the end was she in anything resembling the kind of facilities we're being taken to, and where the music and dancing, she insists, were just for show.
We were told ahead of the visits, if any of you speaks out, you will go to a worse place than this. That's why everyone is scared and does what they are told, including dancing and singing.
We see the same fixed smiles in every facility we visit, while the delighted officials look on. These people have been convicted of no crime, faced no trial, but we're told China now believes it can determine their guilt in advance. Jiang Zhesheng is from the Xinjiang regional government.
Some people, before they commit murder, already show they are capable of killing. Should we wait for them to commit a crime or prevent it from happening by de-extremification education?
With our official tour over, we try to visit other camps, hoping to record independently. Everything we've been shown on our official tour has been designed to prove that these things are just schools. But look at this. This is a vocational skills training centre with high walls, topped with barbed wire, festooned with security cameras, and with a watchtower on each corner.
This is the accommodation block.
And they're building another one next to it.
Okay.
Exactly the same
size. Get ready.
These are places that look much less like schools, and where we're much less welcome. Late at night, we return to one of the facilities that we were taken to by the officials.
You can see them all in the, still at the desks.
Long after dark, the lights still burn, and the sound of thoughts being transformed echoes late into the night.
John Sudworth reporting. Well, we heard from Victor Gao from the China Energy Security Institute a few moments ago. He's based in Beijing. So I asked him, why does the government there feel the need to have these camps in Xinjiang, whether they're for school, vocational training, or even more sinister purposes?
I think the top priority in Xinjiang, as well as in many other parts of China, is to fight against the three evil forces, that is extremism, separatism, and terrorism. Now, when you are calling me from London or anywhere else in the world, Xinjiang may be far away. However, if you really find yourself in Xinjiang, you will know it borders with Afghanistan, it borders with several other Central Asian countries, and there is indeed a very significant spillover of terrorism and extremism from countries like Afghanistan into Xinjiang. And it is a fact that Xinjiang has seen its Uyghurs, thousands of them, fighting in Afghanistan, for example, and more recently fighting in Syria on the side of ISIS, for example. Many of them have been arrested by the Americans and been jailed in Guantanamo.
Undoubtedly, there are extremists everywhere, but judging from the satellite imagery, from the journalism, from all the investigations, these internment camps are holding hundreds of thousands of people, up to 1 million people possibly. Are these all extremists, or are they just people who want to preserve their culture and their religious tradition?
I would be completely surprised if you talk about 1 million people being, for example, locked up in these centers. Secondly, these are training schools. They train people to get onto a better job. And what is at the core of the issue is terrorism.
Victor Gao in Beijing. Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first ever freely elected president, has died after fainting in a courtroom. He was a top figure in the now banned Islamist movement, the Muslim Brotherhood.
أقسم بالله العظيم أن أحافظ مخلصا على النظام الجمهوري.
In a ceremony at the Constitutional Court, Mohamed Morsi swore to protect the Republic, to preserve the Constitution, and to work for the Egyptian people.
Mohamed Morsi was elected in 2012, just over a year after the uprising that saw the end of Hosni Mubarak's 30-year-long rule in Egypt. But his government proved to be unpopular, and after a turbulent year in office and mass protests, he too was ousted and has spent the past 6 years in prison. His family and human rights activists have repeatedly complained about the conditions he faced in jail, saying Mr. Morsi wasn't receiving treatment for serious health problems such as high blood pressure and diabetes, and was being held in solitary confinement. Khaled Dawood is a spokesman for the National Salvation Front, a group which opposed Mohamed Morsi. Speaking from Cairo, Khaled Dawood told me about the part he's played in Egypt's recent tumultuous history.
I did take part in the January 25th revolution against former President Hosni Mubarak. And then when Mr. Morsi became president, unfortunately, the way the Muslim Brotherhood group ran the country turned many Egyptians against them. We felt that we were having an authoritarian dictatorship replaced with a religious dictatorship led by Mr. Morsi and his group.
So you were involved in ousting the person who might have claimed to be Egypt's first democratically elected president. How do you think he was then treated? Mohamed Morsi was put on trial. There have been allegations of torture. He was kept in solitary confinement. Was this the way this uprising should have ended?
Certainly, that's not what we expected. We wanted the removal of the Muslim Brotherhood because we wanted to restore the goals of the January 2011 revolution against Mubarak. We wanted democracy, social justice and respect of human rights. And certainly that's not what Mr. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has offered after becoming president. He basically restored the old authoritarian state, total control over the media. He doesn't stand any opposition whatsoever kind. Even members of my own party are currently inside prison. And even despite any political differences with Mr. Mohamed Morsi, there is no way to deny that he's been kept in very difficult conditions. He was kept in solitary confinement for almost 6 years. He was not allowed any visits by his family over the past 6 years, only two visits, one in 2013 and a second in 2017. He repeatedly complained about lacking proper medical care. He always wanted to receive medical treatment outside prison. Those kinds of demands were denied. So despite any political differences with the Muslim Brotherhood group or my own personal role in asking for the removal, that doesn't mean depriving Mr. Morsi from his right for a fair trial or the right to receive proper medical treatment inside prison, considering that he's 68 years old and that he was a former president of Egypt in any case.
The Muslim Brotherhood tonight have called his death a fully fledged murder, and they've called on Egyptians to gather for a mass funeral. Do you think that call will be heard? Is the Brotherhood still a force in Egypt?
I don't think that this is going to be possible. Security has already been placed on high alert following the announcement of Mr. Morsi's sudden death inside the courtroom today. The Muslim Brotherhood has been weakened tremendously. Thousands of their members have been kept in jail. Already I can see security enforcement in the streets in expectation of any such possible protests. So I don't think that you're going to see those kinds of protests or gatherings that the Muslim Brotherhood is calling for.
How do you think Mohamed Morsi will be remembered?
He will be certainly remembered as the first democratically elected president in Egypt. It's, whether I like the way they run the country or not. I mean, the 2012 elections were the only clean, plural elections we've had in our history as an Egyptian nation. But at the same time, I personally believe that the problem was not with Mr. Mohamed Morsi. Many people thought that he was only a facade for the Muslim Brotherhood group. The country was being run by someone we did not elect, such as the supreme guide of the group, Mr. Mohamed Badia, or his deputy, Mr. Khaira Chater. So many people would rather see him as a sincere person, but he was rather naive, and he was not really the one who was running the show during the short year that he spent in office as president.
Khaled Dawood from Egypt's National Salvation Front, which has always opposed the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, the Conservative MP Crispin Blunt is a former chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Last year, he led a detention review panel. That's a group of parliamentarians mandated by Dr. Morsi's family to review the conditions of his imprisonment. They expressed serious concerns and wrote to the Egyptian ambassador to the UK, but received no response. Well, I asked Crispin Blunt for his reaction to the news of Dr. Morsi's death.
All too sadly predictable, and we predicted it. And the conditions of his detention were such that they were likely to lead to his premature death, and that's sadly all seems to have happened.
You reported on his condition back in 2018. You said he's not receiving the adequate medical care required. What else, in a sense, brought your concerns to the fore?
Well, the conditions of his detention were really so bad that we thought they might well amount to torture, that the conditions were so degrading and below the standards that anyone had any right to expect, that they would constitute cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment. And we said at the time that if he wasn't provided with urgent medical assistance, the damage to his health may be permanent and possibly terminal. And we've been proved right. And what we now need is an independent investigation into his death, conducted by a reputable international authority that can establish whether or not what we believe to be true on the balance of probability from all the evidence we were able to assess, which was not direct, whether that was correct.
You also concluded in that report that he was no ordinary prisoner, but given the international silence or reaction towards the Sisi presidency, how likely is it that there will be any kind of inquiry into his death?
That may be the case, but it still would be appropriate to have one, and any set of nations who are engaging with Egypt and expecting, at the very least, improving standards of justice in Egypt, and the frankly desperate need for Egypt to engage in a serious process of internal reconciliation to deal with the issues that arose out of the election of President Morsi and the Freedom of Justice Party in the first place, and then their removal from office by the military. It's in everybody's interest that that nation is assisted on a path of reconciliation. The killing of its former leader in conditions that amounted to torture in custody, not a very good start.
Do you think that the Foreign Office will be willing to raise these questions?
Well, we need the Foreign Office to do a bit more than raise the questions in private, and there needs to be a public challenge. And it's not just about President Morsi, obviously, that he was the figurehead and obviously the elected president of Egypt who was removed from office. The last time I examined this, there are some 40,000 political prisoners associated with the Freedom and Justice Party who are in custody. Most of them have not had any form of proper trial. And that's really not a situation that should or could continue.
In the past, when the Foreign Office, when the plight of political prisoners and others in Egypt have been raised, the Foreign Office has talked about the UK's desire to pursue a constructive relationship with Egypt. Does that, to some extent, mean not rocking the boat?
It's not the greatest endorsement of the values we ought to be upholding on the international stage.
So you'd like to see the Foreign Office doing more?
I think so, and you've got the dreadful case of Giulia Regeni as well as a number of other cases, and I don't think these incidents can or should pass without some form of measures being taken.
We've heard from the Muslim Brotherhood tonight that they want to see people come out onto the streets, they want to see a mass protest. Do you think that's possible or even likely in Egypt under President Sisi?
Well, that must be a matter for them. We saw what happened when the Muslim Brotherhood demonstrations and the Freedom and Justice Party demonstrations were ended in August 2013. It's not clear just exactly how many people were killed, but they were an awful lot.
the Conservative MP Crispin Blunt. Tensions between Iran and the US are ratcheting up a year after the United States withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. Tehran's warned that it's about to breach a key commitment to that accord. Its atomic energy spokesman said that from June the 27th, Iran would hold more than its permitted stock of low-enriched uranium. The US State Department says it's not surprised by Iran's posturing. Morgana Ortagus is its spokesperson.
This is a pattern of 40 years of behavior. It's consistent with how the Iranian regime behaves. They did this when we were in the JCPOA, right? They continued to build their missile program. We relieved sanctions. They took American sailors hostage. We have seen no moderating behavior by this regime. And so we, you know, would say to the international community that we should not yield to nuclear extortion by the Iranian regime.
Well, Iran's President Rouhani has said he still hopes the deal can be saved by its European backers. But the UK, France and Germany have warned Tehran not to violate the 2015 deal. In the past, they've said they would have no choice but to reimpose their own sanctions, which were lifted in return for those limits on the Iranian nuclear programme. So what will those European backers of the deal do now? Ali Ansari is an expert on Iran at St Andrews University and he joins me now. Good evening.
Good evening.
Ali Ansari, how serious do you think this is for the 2015 nuclear agreement? Is it all but over?
Well, it's certainly been on life support now for some time. And I think we're reaching a sort of a crunch point where the Iranians are going to really try and push as far as they can to see if they can get a much more positive reaction from the Europeans. But from the European perspective, of course, it's an extremely difficult and awkward situation to be in. Caught really between the Iranians and the Americans.
Well, and it's particularly tricky because of that attack last week on the tankers in the Gulf of Oman that Washington blames on Tehran.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think the evidence is mounting, really, that there's been something going on. I mean, the evidence against Iran is certainly mounting, and Iran really needs to provide, you know, needs to address this issue in a much more substantive manner than it has to date.
So what will the Europeans do in this situation? Will we expect an announcement of a formal withdrawal from the deal?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what you're going to see is the Iranians will sort of keep pushing. They haven't actually breached the amounts yet. They're saying they will. I think the Europeans will continue to try and find different routes to address the concerns the Iranians have. But frankly, I think we're going to enter this period of really treading water when actually very little will actually happen on the deal. It's as I said, it's been on life support for some time. But nobody really wants to take that final step and breach it altogether.
But you say treading water, given the kind of rhetoric we've seen coming from Washington, given Iran's willingness now to, in a sense, show that it too will not stand back unchallenged or without taking some kind of action. Isn't this a very dangerous place to be?
Well, I mean, if you look at the agreement itself in 2015, the agreement itself focused quite specifically on Iran's nuclear program in a sort of a quid pro quo for a sort of reduction in its restraints on its nuclear program for various sort of suspensions of sanctions on Iran, but it didn't really deal with the wider problems of the sort of regional issues and tensions. And those had been continuing. And in actual fact, even, you know, in a week after the agreement was reached in 2015, the Iranians really sort of ratcheted up their sort of activities in Syria, for instance. And so this added to various tensions. So I think in many ways, if you look at the rhetoric that's been applied, certainly since the end of the Obama administration, but even behind the scenes, it's certainly coming from Iran, the rhetoric has never really been quite as moderate as we might like to present it.
And if Iran doesn't necessarily have support or any kind of support, diplomatic or otherwise tentative, from the EU, are there others who might come to Iran's aid? Russia, China, perhaps?
Well, I think the Russians definitely will. And, the Chinese will be a little bit more ambivalent because they have much more at stake with the United States. The Russians, I think, have been consolidating their sort of alliance, in a sense, or their grip on Iran for some time. And I think that's the direction of travel in which Iran will go.
Ali Ansari, thank you very much. In 2014, the Islamic State group sacked and then burnt the library at Mosul University in Iraq. The UN called it one of the most devastating acts of destruction of library collections in human history. Well, this evening, a charity called Book Aid International has been holding an event at the British Library as part of its effort to restock the library. Our global affairs correspondent, Naomi Grimley, has been finding out more.
A former student of Mosul University sifts through a pile of broken glass, building rubble and the remains of hundreds of charred books. I can't take in what they did here, she tells her friends in despair. There wasn't much left of Mosul University Library after the Islamic State group burnt it down in a deliberate act of cultural vandalism. Aside from the damage to bricks and mortar, more than a million books were destroyed. Some priceless ancient manuscripts were also looted and will probably never be found again. In the wake of all this, Dr. Alla Hamdan, a lecturer at the university, came up with the idea of the Mosul Book Bridge, a project which aims to enlist the help of universities, charities and publishers in restocking the library.
I have seen books being burned on the floor and some remnant of books. I was really angry for that building, for that library. It's gone. It's been for years there and now it's just disappeared.
Well, I'm in Book Aid International's warehouse in South London, surrounded by pallet upon pallet of books. It is, in fact, a book lover's heaven. Now, they've already sent 8,500 books to Mosul University from here. The last consignment went last week. And the target is to reach 50,000 books by the end of 2024. Getting books to Mosul from the UK has not been easy. Alison Tweed is the chief executive of Book Aid International. Her charity is used to shipping books via boat to Africa, but this project involved some really tricky logistics.
For us, an overland shipment was more complicated, and the books went through Europe. They holidayed in Bulgaria for about 6 weeks, and at each border they had to go through quite an extensive paperwork check. But eventually we got them over the border into Kurdistan, and then the books went on to Mosul. So it was quite complicated. It took about 6 weeks to do it. I mean, I think we've all slightly fallen in love with Mosul and with the partnership that we've got, and the fact that we can make such a difference in a place which has seen such horror and destruction, I think it means a lot.
It wasn't just Mosul University Library which suffered the wrath of so-called Islamic State. This propaganda video by the group showed ancient statues from Mosul Museum being hacked to pieces during the city's occupation. Dr. Mehia Kartham from University College London is part of a group called the Narain Network, which aims to get cultural institutions working together to serve Iraq's post-conflict cultural needs. He explains why Islamic State was so intent on erasing books and history.
It was seen across the country as an effort by the Islamic State to totally eliminate any notion of historical identity in relation to all the multiple groups in the country, whether it be Yazidis, Kurds, Arabs, Shia, Sunni, Turkoman, Christians, Assyrians. And that was the biggest threat of the Islamic State.
That report from Naomi Grimley. We've been talking about the rising tensions between Iran and the US on tonight's programme. Well, Dina Nayeri is someone who fled from Iran to America in the 1980s. Her new book, The Ungrateful Refugee, has been published to coincide with Refugee Week, and the title reflects her own experience as someone seeking sanctuary in a foreign country and culture. Her parents were doctors and they lived a comfortable middle-class life in the Iranian city of Isfahan. But her mother's conversion to Christianity and her very public proclamation of her faith meant the family were in danger. And when Dina was 8 years old, they had no choice but to leave. Their eventual arrival and then acceptance in America has left Dina feeling that all refugees spend their lives being made to express gratitude.
I think it's just this natural instinct to want to feel useful, but then to want to feel the appreciation of the person that you're inviting into your community. I think what people don't see is that from the other side, getting that solicitation almost is really very uncomfortable. It robs them of their dignity and it makes them have to posture. And I think this desire for this posturing of gratitude from refugees and immigrants, you know, I've gotten questions like, well, why shouldn't they be grateful? Well, of course they're grateful. Of course I'm grateful. Every moment of my life, I'm grateful. But it's a private emotion.
So does this gratefulness then come also with a negation of anything positive about the place you've left?
I think so. I think that's a really big part of it. I think because, you know, the narrative that people crave is one in which their home and the place they live and their identity is better. And when they come, they should know their place.
The time when you were a refugee arguably was perhaps a time when there was a political compulsion, certainly to be seen to be open to refugees. Yes. Where we've arrived now, the rise of populism, the rise of nativism, the sense that there's sort of uncontrolled numbers of refugees, yeah. It's a much more negative discourse. So if your experience was bad, how does it compare to what's happening now?
The conversation has changed to something so ugly now because it is no longer about individuals and about saving lives. Now everything has been aggregated up to this monstrous, kind of fearsome thing, which they call the refugee crisis. And it's made to look that way with falsehoods and lies. Also just with the idea that people who are born in a safe place are entitled to sole ownership of that place. And I'm really surprised how quickly this change took place.
Do you have any sympathy, though, with those who feel they simply can't cope? If you think about Germany in the summer of 2015 and a wave of people arriving, a million people arriving, and that sense of displacement from the people who were already there. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sympathy for that?
Of course. Of course I understand. I mean, when your surroundings change and your home changes, you naturally become fearful for yourself, for your children. You worry about their future. But I think the answer to that is, again, you know, to think bigger and to understand how you ended up in that place. And what is the alternative for these people? Is it to remain where they are and die?
When you now think about Iran specifically, mm-hmm. How do you feel about it as a country? It's certainly in the news today. There is that sense of Iran is a global demon, if you like, for the United States, axis of evil, all of that. How does that affect your perception of the country you left, albeit as a young child?
I am not sympathetic to the Islamic Republic at all, but I also don't like having the entire country and its people maligned and to have the individual people made to suffer because of, again, policies like you see now in the West, which are not really about freeing the people from the oppression of the Islamic Republic. They're about a whole set of other motivations and desires.
But for you, then, Iran remains a place of memory.
Oh, yes. The Iran that went into my consciousness when I was young was a pre-revolutionary Iran. I was yearning for that pre-revolutionary Iran. I miss wading in the sea, you know, with my legs bare. I don't want to go to my country and cover my hair. I want to go to one of those fish shacks, you know, by the seaside and swim and eat the fish and talk to Iranians in Farsi, listen to old music. But, you know, will that be possible?
Writer Dina Nayeri. Just time for tonight's closing headline. Tensions between the US and Iran have intensified, with Washington urging the international community not to yield to what it called nuclear extortion by Tehran. Iran's warned that in 10 days' time it expected to breach the international agreement to restrict its nuclear activities. That's The World Tonight. I'm Rithula Shah. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.